high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Hello, this is GW speaking and reading for a change, rather than wearing my fingers out on a keyboard. And the reason for that departure is that we haven't done enough audio lately. Indeed, we haven't really done enough since we got started. And I thought it would be good to return again to the format, and to do it on a subject that is quite difficult to explicate via the written word, but which might benefit from the audio treatment. If, of course, you'll be generous enough to stick with me to the end. The end, in this case, should not be too long in coming. I hope I can get through in about 20 minutes, but that's just for me. There's going to be some music to add to that, and it'll be quite serious music, I'm afraid. Not at all the modernist fare that fans of Sorin have grown used to. And we'll feel our way around some conceptual stuff that interests me very much, and that I think is well worth airing. In fact, I'll go further than that and say that nobody really interested in being on the radical right, or the cutting edge of the radical right, could conceivably lay claim to being such until he or she can parley about this sort of thing. So, I'm going to begin with an evocation. A musical evocation, rather loud and brassy, like all three we'll hear today. The background to this one is romantic, musically, but on the cusp. It takes us back to a point in time that, to my mind, was pivotal in the slow and seemingly ineluctable process that has shifted Western man, European man, whatever one wants to call him, out of an organic, tradition-centered way of life and into what we regard today as modernity, the modern era. I will put a date on that in a moment, because I incline to the belief that 18th and 19th century urbanisation, not some form of proto-leftism, and decidedly not the dreaded hyper-ethnocentric, hyper-opportunistic Jew, but urbanisation was the shock to the system, the nervous system of this newly industrialised West, that really catapulted us into the period, prolonged period, of self-confrontation and self-destruction, at the end of which we find ourselves today. And it did it, of course, through the agency of those Enlightenment ideas and values of liberty, endless progress, equality, and universal brotherhood. Now, that date. This first 90-second burst of music records an event in the life of the German composer, the last master of the German symphonic tradition, Richard Strauss. This event occurred in August of 1878. That's all of a dozen years before the onset of Fin de Siècle Paris, the doomed period of bourgeoisie and self-indulgence and sensual excess, which came to a very sudden stop in 1914, and which, incidentally, is what I take to represent the real fruit of liberalism, of the pursuit of individual liberty. Because, like it or not, that's what the will of ordinary people gravitates towards, given the chance. In present-day terms, their lives very easily revolve around the timeshare in Puerto Banus, and Friday night clubbing, and the worship of celebrity and premiership footballers, and so on. Among people of all classes, individualism has always tended to nihilism, to the abdication of values, because individualism, as processed by liberal politics, stands in opposition to ethne, to the duties that accompany kinship. And it's entropic. It pitches the collective unit downwards, into the tailspin we know so well, and fear for our children's sake so much. But in 1878, the world was still innocent in that respect, or, if only fairly innocent, certainly a deal more healthy. On one summer's night of that year, somewhere deep in the Bavarian alpine countryside, 14-year-old Richard Strauss pushed back his bedclothes, 2 a.m. in the morning, got himself dressed in good outdoor clothing, and joined a party for the 5-hour trek to the summit of a nearby peak. The experience so impressed itself on Strauss's young spirit that over 3 decades later, he devoted himself to crafting it into a symphonic form. It took him, in all, 4 years, working on and off, to bring it to the auditorium, something he finally achieved when World War I was already a year in. His Alpine Symphony runs out to about 48 minutes, which is decidedly on the long side, and we're only going to hear a very short excerpt from it. It is categorized as a tone poem in a single movement. The brass leads in with a falling note that stands, I think, for sober contemplation as the climbing party of Strauss's imagination assembles in the dark. At 2 minutes in, the first fingers of light are playing over the mountains. A few bars, and they have transmuted into the blinding brilliancy of an alpine dawn, Helios rising. My apologies for the quality of the recording, by the way, and it's rather full-hearted and loud. There's absolutely no argument that in this brief passage Strauss gives us a clarion call as bright and hard as sunlight on the eye in the clean alpine air. One can quite imagine his awed Apollonian climbers gazing upward beyond the tree line, perhaps to where their route skirts the cliffs, still all in shadow, and melds into a vast rocky shoulder in sunlight above them. And with the rising sun there rises in the climbers, and in us as we listen, the revelation of the scale and grandeur of nature, and significantly, in the face of that, of the seriousness of human endeavour, and the profound indomitability of human resources, the human spirit. Seriousness and indomitability make climbers of us all in life, and the lack of them consigns us to a life of Dionysian purposelessness in the valleys below, a life that breeds a lightness of character, what Tom Sunich calls a lack of the sense of the tragic. So this is about the qualities we draw from our collective life and put back. It's about how we live. What we can really take from these few bars of music is the importance of human purpose, something walked in and infused with the light. Crucially for the thinking nationalist, or the conservative, the traditionalist, the racialist, the dissident, it has to be a particular kind of purpose, a vivifying purpose, in total opposition to the one assigned to us by the rationalist philosophers. You know, the unfettered will, that paradigm that drains every red corpuscle out of us, and all love of kind. That purpose was flawed from the very beginning. It was fatally abstract. And its high-minded proponents were, and are, completely blind to its real-life consequences. Human lives and Enlightenment ideas about lives just do not deal in the same currency. Really, how can you organize life on the basis of anti-nature, of tabula rasa, and expect paradise on earth? So naturally we dissidents of the political heart reject liberalism's purpose as well as its paradise. But it is the former rejection, this clarion call to absolute individualism, that we know we must actively and intelligently promote. We must replace the core meaning of the liberal zeitgeist. Now, this ambition is what separates us from the plain social conservative who rails at single motherhood or drug addiction. And it separates us from populist European nationalists such as the BNP and FN, whose effective focus is merely anti-immigrant. Replacing the core objective of a political philosophy, giving people another light to follow, kills that philosophy. It sweeps away the ground on which stood the elite, who, incidentally, if the apparatchiks of the old Soviet bloc are anything to go by, will be very quick to find a way to survive. It won't be long before they have dropped all the old parties and learned the new. No doubt, the attractions of power and greed make that well worthwhile. Among intellectuals and all peoples of conviction, however, the revolution would be more thoroughgoing. There is a magnetic quality that would occur. Hitherto excluded thinkers would be attracted to the opening up of new intellectual vistas, while the guardians of the exhausted old order would find themselves repelled from public life entirely. This is, then, an ambition on a grand scale, politically the grandest, I don't doubt it. From its revolutionaries, it requires all of that seriousness of mind and indomitability of spirit I've talked about. But what has it received thus far? Well, past attempts to scale this towering cliff face have resulted only in the pitching of a few camps here and there, most of them on the lower slopes, and most of them deserted now. There is the camp of the resacralizers, and that of the neo-paganists, that of the third positionists, the European neuritists, that one's still occupied, the traditionalist schoolers, the national anarchists, who are going strong, and national Bolsheviks. Here is localism and ethnic federalism, the life of glory and the Aryan spirit. Fay and de Benoist, Guénon, Junger, Dugin, Evola. And the only, or certainly the leading American in this rarefied European company, Francis Parker Yockey. Well, how do we chop this stuff up into competing clarion calls, the better to assess what sort of job they're really doing in replacing liberal individualism? If we speak in the broadest possible sense and strip away all the peripherals, the strategic silence of Alain de Benoist and repatriation, for example, and the wholly activist manifesto approach of Guillaume Fay, we can arrive at two great calls here, just two, each with a distinct, but by no means mutually exclusive, creative goal. One is the mournful communitarian herbivore you might hear calling in the darkness before dawn. It wants, quite justifiably, a return to the organic, the traditional, the small of scale. But it invents what it cannot possibly know and rejects science as an impostor. In consequence, the call is rather to what supposedly once belonged to us, what supposedly was proven by history, by time, to work. It can be anti-nationalist, anti-modernist, and anti-capitalist all at the same time, seeing village-level folk autonomy as the ideal organizational structure. It may have a spiritual component, and that is usually somewhat gratuitously pre-Christian, because the real motivation here is to be anti-Christian, of course. Alternatively, it may turn its nose up at mere wodenism and exchange the rune for the Sanskrit, laying claim to the eternal wisdom of the Vedas, or whatever. I don't know what's worse. I think this sort of stuff should be kept well away from politics, but then I am a gross materialist, according to the people who go in for it. Since one must give this general clarion call a name, even if none will really do, volkishness seems to me to suffice. For all the invention involved, the strands I have grouped here have in common a sincere effort to discover and work at what is real in us collectively, in contrast to the perceived falsehood and self-betrayal of the liberal individualist life. The clarion call that stands apart from this, but of course not in opposition to it, has a carnivorous history. This one is race as the archetypal quest to escape from bondage to some dark Tellurian force, Jews, usually. Thereafter, there's the promised fulfillment of some golden collective destiny, ordained by whatever philosopher thought it up. It's good theatre, the politics of the epic. But the pursuit of a collective life does not leave much room for respect of the individual. A higher value, by far, obtains on adherence than independence, and on discipline than debate. The highest value, and the definition of honour, is loyalty, and anybody who's ever studied the SS will know all about that. Politically, the system can be socialist in a Strasserite sense. It is highly apt to focus itself on the person of a charismatic, even messianic leader. It is given to a collective arrogance, and its name is palingenesis, meaning heroic rebirth.